On 88.1 WIPR, I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. We'll start with a conversation with Steve Phillips, the co-founder of PowerPack.org, which has worked to mobilize voters in underrepresented communities. In his recent book, Brown is the New White, he argues that people of color and progressive whites constitute a new American majority, and that acting with an understanding of this new reality is key to the future success of the Democratic Party. And Sammy Hoy has been at the helm of MICA for the past 2 years, and he has quickly established himself as one of the region's most imaginative arts leaders. How does an art school fit into the fabric of Baltimore, and how does the city inform the training of the next generation of artists and creators? Theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews Hand to God at the Studio Theater in Washington. Maryland Morning gets started right after these headlines.
I'm producer Kathleen Cahill. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, and 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Morning, everybody. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Election Day is less than 3 months away. Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are appealing to various constituencies in and out of their parties, from white working-class men and evangelicals on the right to progressives and people of color on the left. Trump's support among people of color is almost non-existent in some states, and Clinton's support among progressives is still, perhaps, a work in progress, as she tries to include in her coalition independents and moderate Republicans who are turned off by Trump. Earlier this year, I spoke with a political scholar who believes that Clinton can win without the support of so-called white swing voters. He contends that a powerful new coalition exists that could easily decide the outcome of many key races, including the one for the White House. Steve Phillips is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and the co-founder of a social justice organization called PowerPack, which has mobilized voters in support of political candidates like Barack Obama, Cory Booker, and the Attorney General of California, Kamala Harris. In a recent book written before the strong primary showing of Bernie Sanders, Phillips explains how the racial and ethnic demography of the United States has changed so dramatically over the last 50 years that never before has the progressive movement in America had as good a chance of dominating the political landscape as it has now. The book is called Brown is the New White: How the Demographic Revolution Has Created a New American Majority. Steve Phillips joined me on the line from his home in San Francisco. Good morning, Mr. Phillips. Thanks for getting up early for us.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
So your basic thesis is that if, in terms of the electorate, if we combine people of color with white progressives, that is enough to create a very powerful political bloc. Explain the math. How's that work?
Right. So what has happened is that the composition of the country has changed so much since the 1960s and the Civil Rights movement and the Immigration and Nationality Act in particular, that people of color have grown from 12% of the population to 38%. And so that comprises the cornerstones of what I'm calling the new American majority in alliance with the meaningful minority of progressive whites. There's always section of whites who vote Democratic and who have sided with people of color over the years. And so looking at exit polls, that's about 40% of whites. So if you take 40% of whites, or should I say 39%, because that was Obama's re-election number, and 81% of people of color, and look at that in terms of the entire eligible voter pool of the country, that's 51% of all the people within the country. And my thesis is that that is what elected Obama and, most importantly, reelected him when he lost 5 million white votes but still got reelected.
And, of course, the ramifications of this include the fact that you talk about the preoccupation that Democrats have had in chasing the so-called white swing voter. You talk about how people are sort of fixated on this magical number of 2044, the year in which the United States will become a so-called majority-minority country. Why is it, in your estimation, so inadvisable for Democrats to be so preoccupied with these white swing voters now?
Because I talk in the book about what I call the tyranny of the white swing voter. And so historically, politics in this country has been a competition between progressive whites and conservative whites for the white swing in the middle. And in order to win over those votes, historically the approach has been to moderate one's politics, to mute one's call for social justice. And that goes all the way back to Thomas Jefferson drafting the Declaration of Independence and taking out the references to slavery, to Abraham Lincoln in the debates in 1859 saying he supported ending slavery but not equality between the races, and all the way up to 2014 when the Democrats ran away from immigration reform, ran away from health care, ran away from their black president in the Senate. And it results in its downward spiral because it's ineffective in winning over the whites in the middle, and it also results in a diminished level of enthusiasm on the part of the voters of color who are necessary to comprise the majority to win.
The book is called Brown is the New White. My guest is the author Steve Phillips on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. So in your title, Brown is the New White, you're basically asserting that whites can no longer be the starting point. We've got to be the Democratic Party in particular has to be taking much more seriously the political power and capacity of minorities and white progressives. That's going to require a big epiphany, isn't it, on the part of the leadership of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party?
Yes, it does. But you would think that people would have grasped that from the Obama election, the Obama numbers, but the fact that they don't is really what compelled me to try to write the book, to try to send a real wake-up call and inject a sense of urgency into the political population. The incontrovertible evidence of the past 8 years is that when we've had large and enthusiastic turnout of voters of color and progressive whites, that has resulted in victories, 2008 and 2012. When people have not been mobilized, not been inspired to turn out, we've lost and lost badly. In 2010 and 2014, that's how the House was lost and that's how the Senate was lost. So if you look at the numbers, it's actually fairly clear. But for whatever reason, too many people who run Democratic politics remain obsessed with this population that is shrinking, elusive, and we have been ineffective at reaching.
One of the fiscal ramifications of this, or the money ramifications of this, you talk about the election of Kay Hagan, that she ran when she lost her North Carolina Senate seat. She spent $19 million on attack ads against her Republican opponent, who eventually won that race. And you make a very interesting argument about how that money could have been spent and how that might have affected the outcome.
Right. And so that's one of the clearest examples. This is actually the outside groups in that race. So, and again, it's just a question of, I'm talking about Chapter 6, talks about invest wisely, and how do you actually look at your spending your money to get the 50% plus one. So you can either try to persuade the so-called likely voters, which is more white than the overall population, and that was the point of these $19 million in attack ads, it was to try to change the minds of those white swing voters, or you can invest your money in trying to inspire and mobilize and turn out your own base. And if the progressive forces had hired, they could have hired 400 full-time staff people going door-to-door, making phone calls, turning out friends and neighbors over the course of an entire year. If each of those people had just gotten three additional votes per week, with 2 weeks off for vacation, Hagan would have won the election.
You commissioned a report called the Fannie Lou Hamer Report, in which you audited Democratic spending in 2010 and 2014. The spending on campaigns was more than $500 million, but it all went to a very somewhat rarefied constituency, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. So it's it was the first audit ever done of Democratic Party spending. And so over $500 million spent by the various party committees, 97% of the money went to white consultants. And so in a party where the voters are 46% people of color, and so there's a profound disconnect in terms of who is making the ads, who is doing the outreach, who's running the campaigns, and who comprises the voters that are necessary to victory.
And that really is sort of at the crux of this as well, is just that the folks who are running the show when it comes to running these political campaigns, their perspective isn't one of people of color and people who've been generally marginalized. I mean, later in the program, we're going to talk about the Academy Awards and the woman who created the hashtag Oscars So White. It seems like there's an awful lot of parallels here when it comes to the Democratic Party and the members of the Academy.
Yeah, well, very much so, man. That Hollywood is one of the best examples of the persistence of, really, frankly, the preference for white people in terms of hiring. That 95% of the lead actors in Hollywood and shows are white in a society that's 62% white. I mean, that does not occur by accident. That does not occur without a fairly active, although probably, you know, unconscious or semi-conscious, bias in favor of hiring whites. And so, and that's what you saw, frankly, in Maryland with the Senate race. You know, two good candidates there, but the U.S. has never had has had one black woman in the U.S. Senate in the history of the United States. And so, rather than let that race play out, 2 days after Mikulski retired, Harry Reid came in and endorsed the white male candidate rather than either backing the black woman candidate or at least letting them compete. And so that's another example of the failure to invest in and prioritize the new American majority.
But of course, so much of this does, when it comes to having a powerful political voice and capacity, it requires folks to show up to the polls. And you've mentioned that in 2010, 2014, it wasn't necessarily swing voters fled, but we had a very low turnout among a progressive coalition that included people of color. What's it going to take to get folks out to the polls to vote?
Well, it requires both a combination of a policy agenda, which speaks to people's interest and inspires them, as well as a massive investment of resources in terms of hiring from the communities, hiring consultants who know how to reach the communities, and being able to engage and pull out their friends and neighbors to get them to the polls. People don't realize that Obama had 200,000 more black votes in Ohio in 2012 than he did in 2010. And the way he did that was he had 600 full-time staff people working for more than a year, partnering with churches, going door-to-door, identifying people in the neighborhoods. It's that kind of work that's necessary and effective in terms of getting people out to vote.
Steve Phillips, his book is a really interesting read. Check it out. It's called Brown is the New White, How the Demographic Revolution Has Created a New American Majority. We've got a link to more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Mr. Phillips, thanks for your time and thanks for the book. I really enjoyed it.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Steve Phillips, we spoke last February. Coming up after a break for the news, another visit to the Maryland Morning Archive, a conversation with Sammy Hoy, the president of the Maryland Institute College of Art, and theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews Hand to God at the Studio Theater in Washington. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
Is there an issue that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org, or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Sammy Hoy is the president of the Maryland Institute College of Art and arguably one of the city's most important cultural leaders. Last May, we spoke on graduation day for MICA students just before he gave his second commencement address since his appointment to the MICA presidency in 2014. In that reflective mood, we talked about how the training of creative artists encompasses much more than lessons in painting and sculpture, and how both emerging and established artists have responded to the uprising of the spring of 2015. Sammy, it's great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Tom, for having me on the show.
Your tenure at MICA, the 2 years you've been here, has straddled the uprising of last April. So you were here for about a year before that happened,
right,
and now you've been here for about a year after that's happened. What's your take on what has changed in the two short years that you've been here in Baltimore and how the paroxysms that the city went through has affected your students and your institution, MICA?
Well, I think the larger context of the city is, has gone through some very interesting changes over the last 2 years. The underlying dynamics remain pretty much the same, but I think the civic unrest related to Freddie Gray's death certainly has awakened the kind of consciousness of the city for, you know, people to be not be able to take for granted or let passively let the inequity in the city's history and reality stand. I think that's a very hopeful public will that everyone really realizes that we have to work together now to not only address the strong parts of the city, but we have to find ways pervasively through the city to lift inequity and remedy that situation. And so that provides a fantastic social context for a school that's very civically minded. I think one of the merits of MICA is that we have always thought of kind of art and design education in the larger socio-economic context, not just in the cultural arena. So I think that allows our faculty and students to be even more imaginative and engaging with different dimensions of the city to create truly reciprocal kind of learning, giving experiences that kind of city partners and us are 50-50 partners, really trying to improve wellness, you know, for all, and then also for faculty and cities to learn in the meantime.
And that's a much broader portfolio than the traditional art school used to have. You know, this notion of being connected in a very real way. Sometimes it's a financial connection. It's certainly an emotional connection. It's certainly a physical connection. Your students are living in the city. Some are doing work in some of our most impoverished neighborhoods. That's a very different model, isn't it, than 15 years ago, 20 years ago, when people went to art school to learn how to paint and sculpt and do stuff.
Yeah, I think the days of like the lone genius artists working in a studio is long, long over. And nowadays, the possibilities for creative professionals, or what we call creatives now, to contribute on many different levels really necessitate an art school to think very deeply and broadly about our roles in society and how we actually teach our students and learn from them. You know, at the same time, they bring actually a lot of assets and resources to the college and to the faculty and the staff. So I think MICA has always been the forefront of that kind of wide angle view of art and design education. So MICA was one of the first schools that created a social design program.
What's a social design program? What does that mean?
Yeah. Social design is a one-year master level program at MICA in which we really look at how design thinking can work with complex issues in society, whether it's poverty or HIV prevention or housing issues, and bring kind of creative minds to work alongside other sectors and public policymakers or community leaders to co-fashion solutions and but really bring the unique thinking of artists and designers to the table. And I think that kind of insertion in a way of or embedment of kind of creative intervention was fairly new when this program was founded, and also it has been a leading program in the country and actually in the world.
That's wild. I mean, I think for a lot of people it would come as a big surprise to think that you can go to MICA and think about poverty and HIV and housing issues.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and also our students have actually terrific career outcomes. So one of our current year graduate actually is working with the government in D.C. and then intern in a very good position, and then her work is so impressive that position is now being turned into a full-time position. And and this is actually just one program, but I would say the kind of civic engagement spirit to be through the school. We have an office of community engagement that works with AmeriCorps and teaching, and many of the participants, most of them MICA students, actually teach after school arts program or engage in other kind of social programs.
How do you make the argument that these creatives, as we call them now, people who in many cases work in different platforms, you're no longer just a painter. I mean, you're right. Doing painting, you're a slam poet, you've got a band, mm-hmm. and you've got a startup. How do you make the argument that the training at an art school like Micah is going to really prepare that person to make contributions in a really meaningful way to the companies and foundations and institutions that are, you know, trying to move society in general forward.
Sure. Well, let me start by saying that we still love painting, we still love photography, we still love sculpture. So for those students who choose to focus solely on that, we would want them to do so. But at the same time, as times change and possibilities expand for our graduates, just like when when photography first was invented, I think painting felt very threatened, this new technology had come along and it's going to kill the current practice and medium. And that proved not to be the case. I think what happened at the end is that the spectrum of expression and possibilities just got extended. So in many ways, the reason kind of Micah has added these kind of social opportunities for creatives to contribute to society in powerful ways, it's a way of extension. And we're doing actually more than just actually community engaged work. For example, later on, we can talk about actually the entrepreneurial training we are now bringing to Micah as well. So we are really very actively thinking about how do we extend the spectrum of preparation for our graduates so that they can choose whoever they want to be when they exit Micah and go into the world. And we also want them to give the richest toolbox possible to combine personal success with, I would say, worldly and societal contributions.
On 88.1 WIPR, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Sammy Hoy is my guest this morning. He is the president of MICA, the Maryland Institute College of Art. They celebrate their commencement today. This afternoon, the undergraduates will get their diplomas, and this evening at 5 o'clock at the Meyerhoff, the graduate students will get theirs. We did a panel, you and me and Marin Alsop and Kwame Kwe Arma, from Center Stage. Marin, of course, the music director of the Baltimore Symphony. We were discussing things at the Light City event that happened, I guess, about a month ago.
Terrific event.
And the theme was innovation and imagination about moving the city forward. It was very much focused on these problems of inequity and racial and economic inequality that undergirded the violence that we experienced last year. And we talked about the actual practical real life things that arts institutions like the Symphony or Center Stage or MICA or the Choral Arts Society for that matter can do to move the ball forward, to make progress. And on the one hand, it seems unlikely that institutions like that would be able to help when the problems tend to be identified as, these are folks who have health problems. They have they're living in crime areas of high crime that are just so difficult to survive in. There's food deserts. There's access to jobs and opportunities is limited. How does an institution like MICA or the Symphony or anything else actually make a difference for the folks who are living in Harlan Park and Sandtown, Winchester, and Oliver?
Well, I think we have to enter this kind of joint solution arena with a great degree of imagination and humility. We have to know that we can contribute a lot, but also be aware that we cannot be the sole provider of solutions. I think these are very comprehensive issues, and therefore they require very comprehensive solution. And the very rich and diverse cultural assets and creative assets of a city are native strengths of Baltimore. And it would be inconceivable in a way to have any real solution without incorporating part of having kind of the arts being part of the team that would come up with different kind of remedies. But at the same time, the arts cannot do it alone. So I think we are really trying very hard to convince others, how can we build this multi-sector, partnership in coming together. So for example, our social design program, actually one of the most impressive projects during the last few years about urban farming, how can we work with community members to identify the needs and kind of bring urban farming to food deserts, in the city. That's just one example. But that would not be alone. It has to really couple with, public housing policy, with, social services and, and transportation, safety, etc. So I think that we are really trying to be part of the infrastructure and part of the ecosystem that really will bring strong solutions, you know, to the city. If you think about this, what is the future for Baltimore? I think one of the natural destinations for Baltimore is to become a capital for creative innovation. And a lot of innovations is already happening in technology sector. We are, this region is one of the strongest actually tech sector now. And we have a lot of health innovation going on with Johns Hopkins, University of Maryland, Baltimore, and other great institutions. This is a Ed and Matt's town. So how can we bring kind of cultural and design creativity, into the formula so that we actually can and have a combustible level of success. If you think about Apple products, it's a combination of technology and, design and actually and service thinking. Really, those are the three components that really are so successful. So I think in the current thinking, what is missing is that active incorporation of artists and designers, and we hope that Michael will be able to contribute. And we are also thinking very aggressively about how to use the creative economy to kind of lift the city, but not just focusing in the corridor of success, which extends from downtown to Mount Vernon to some Station North, which is a kind of emerging corridor of area of success, but to think about how we can use the innate capacity of human beings to be creative, to nurture and bring diverse citizens from many, many neighborhoods around the city into the opportunities to be successful through creativity. And we actually have an initiative that we are launching right now and fundraising for to do so.
We'll just talk about that in a minute. On 88.1, that's Sammy Hoy. He's the president of MICA. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Maryland Morning. There are a couple of articles a year or two ago, places like The Atlantic Magazine and The Economist, and they tried to equate the investment that a student would make in going to art school with the investment that that student would, with the return on investment that she would get from getting a job. And basically the thrust of these articles was, don't go to art school. I mean, it's just, get a real job, in other words. That's nothing new to artists. Mm-hmm. Artists have been hearing that since time eternal. But there are others who say that the MFA, the Master's in Fine Arts, is the new MBA, the Master's in Business Administration. What's your take on that?
Well, first of all, I think it's unfortunate that some of the media and even some of the kind of government attention has been focusing on the first job out of school being the measure of return on investment, while we should be looking at the lifelong success and lifelong skills building of actually graduates of not just art school, but colleges of education as being the true return on investment. So national studies have shown that while art school graduates may not have the highest paying first job, they are by far the happiest cohort of graduates of any disciplines on a lifelong basis. They also stay in their fields of studies doing work related to the field of studies by many percents more than many other disciplines. So I think we have to kind of focus on that. But at the same time, the notion that the MFA is the MBA does have a lot of merit these days because we have basically seen kind of the failure or the insufficiency of traditional kind of linear thinking and kind of the more creative kind of social thinking of kind of artists and designers, I think can bring a different kind of approach to solve many of the social and environmental issues that we have nowadays. And I think, again, this is the kind of education MICA is trying to fashion, is to look at where does creativity innovation really resides, and how can we partner our students and faculty with other sectors. I think the future also lies in this very active interaction between art and design and technology, business, health, and sciences for, again, the most comprehensive, most innovative possibilities.
Let's talk about this entrepreneurship program at MICA that you mentioned. Last week, Nathan Sterner here on our show talked to three students at MICA who were awarded sort of startup money, startup grants. It was kind of like Shark Tank on television, where you pitch ideas for businesses. Yeah.
We do it in a much kinder way.
One of them, she was doing microgreens. Another was creating a podcast, and another was creating venues and platforms for artists. And you actually gave them a chunk of change. It was several hundred thousand dollars was distributed, I think. Where'd that come from? That's from an art school. I mean, giving money to their students to start businesses.
Right. Well, first of all, we have to thank the Philip E. and Carol R. Radcliffe Foundation. They really had the foresight of coming to MICA and partnering with us to re-infuse entrepreneurship into art design training, which is quite rare still nowadays. And our belief is that, again, artists and designers, they are, in a way, they have been participate in the gig economy and have been entrepreneurs actually even before entrepreneurship becomes a hot and trendy word. Because if you think about artists and designers, many of them are freelancers, and many of them also very comfortable in working with multiple identities. You know, they could be teaching one day and creating art the next day, and then volunteering nonprofits, you know, sometimes in the same part of the day. So that kind of flexibility, that kind of, you know, comfort with inventing kind of one's, you know, livelihood, and be able to also reinvent oneself or one's practice time and again over a lifetime, kind of anticipates the current you know, kind of contingency, kind of, you know, worker economy. And so if we think about that, we really feel that what we need is actually bring some of the principles of venture capital and also entrepreneurship, again, more imaginatively into art and design education. So we very boldly hired a entrepreneurship evangelist on campus last year. And based on that, we actually created a kind of pitch and pop-up competition.
Is this person's title is actually entrepreneurship evangelist?
That's correct.
Lord,
that's
correct. Imagine what she wears.
So, I think it's one way kind of bust the perception, the stereotypical perception that this doesn't belong in art school. I think it actually belongs in art school. Yeah. I think, yes. And so I think we actually have students advertise the program, and I think with $100,000 to be distributed, and at the end of the year, it's very attractive. And any students who are interested in participate have to go through entrepreneurship boot camp. And then eventually, this is going to be incorporated into the curriculum at MICA.
All right. Well, you have a very busy day, sir. We're going to let you get on to your other duties, and thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much.
By. Always good to see you. Sammy Hoy is the president of the Maryland Institute College of Art, a post he's held since 2014. We spoke last May as he was about to preside at MICA's 191st commencement ceremony. We've got a link to MICA on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Coming up after a break for the news, theater critic J. Wynn Russick joins me with a review of Hand to God at the Studio Theater in Washington. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stick around.
Join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall, joined in the studio by our good friend, theater critic J. Wynn Russick. Morning, Judy.
Good morning, Tom.
So you have been to see a play called Hand to God. It's down in D.C. at the Studio Theater. Now, of course, the word hand in the title, Hand to God, refers to a hand puppet. Puppet isn't, of course, the first thing that people think of when they hear this phrase, you know. So how does this apply here?
Well, Tom, let me say first that this play is set primarily in a church basement where a recently widowed mother is teaching her teenage son and two other teenagers to make puppets for a church puppet show. And her son, Jason, has made a hand puppet named Tyrone. Tyrone is the first character that we see in the play, so you know he's going to play a significant role. And as the play progresses, Tyrone essentially possesses Jason, heart, soul, and mind. This play was nominated for 5 2015 Tony Awards. It was a really big hit on Broadway, and Studio's production is the first regional production it's had since Broadway. It's already been extended twice. Tom, I've reviewed some very good shows this summer, but Hand to God is the best play and the best production I've reviewed this summer. And I have to say also, I don't know if you're aware of this, but puppet ministry apparently is a real thing.
I did not know that.
I didn't either. But but the playwright, Robert Askin's mother, ran a puppet ministry at the Texas church they attended, and Robert was one of her puppeteers.
Hand to God, that's true, huh?
Yes, Hand to God.
So the lead actor then in this play actually has to play two characters, the human and the puppet. How does he do? That's tough.
It is, and he does remarkably well. He's an actor named Liam Ford. He had no prior puppetry experience, and he does play these two very distinct characters, but they're both sort of part of the same person, kind of like an evil inner twin. But he uses very different voices, and they change as the situation gets more dire, and that happens because Jason and Tyrone are increasingly at odds. Tyrone is a vicious, satanic creature. The play, I should say, has...
Just what you want attached to your arm.
Yes, exactly. Well, you got it. And the play also, I should say, has a lot of profanity, a lot of blasphemy. But Tyrone, for all of that, is a truth teller in terms of saying the things that timid Jason can't say, particularly about his feelings. For example, about a girl that Jason has a crush on and the bully who taunts him.
He's not very nice.
No, he's not! He's not very nice. And he's already had your precious Jessica.
No, he has...
Yes, sir? I'll rip you in half again. You try to so much as take me off your hand! Next time you wake up, it'll be with me, stapled to your arm!
Oh, drama, drama. So puppets are like a thing. I mean, they've been a thing for a while now. I mean, did the Studio Theater have a special, you know, puppet designer for this show?
Well, they did hire someone with a lot of puppetry experience and background, a woman named Chelsea M. Warren. She also designed the costumes for the show. I should describe Tyrone. He starts out, he's orange to start with, and he has a little tuft of turquoise hair coming out of the top of his head. So he's kind of charming, but there's a lot of violence in Hand to God, and there actually, I believe, are several Tyrone puppets as he keeps coming back looking worse and worse for wear.
Well, we all know about that. So now you mentioned that this was on Broadway, you know, won all these Tonys and stuff. Did you see it on Broadway?
Tony nominations, but hey, that's something
too. That's still a big thing.
I didn't see it on Broadway. I very, very much wanted to. My understanding is that Studio's production is actually darker than it was on Broadway. But the most obvious difference is that Broadway was done in a proscenium stage, so everything was happening right in front of you. And at Studio, the set designer, Daniel Conway, has done this total immersion environmental approach. We are in the church basement. The program is the newsletter of the Mount Logan Lutheran Church of Cypress, Texas. We sit at folding tables with checkered tablecloths. There are religious posters on the wall.
Yep, and, been there, done that.
Oh, well, yeah. But there are actually puppet-making supplies and instructions on each table.
Haven't done that, yeah.
Well, I did. And in the second act, I should say, for all this cheeriness, in the second act, the set is transformed, and it becomes kind of scary and funny at the same time. For the director, Joni Schultz, and the fight coach, Rob Hunter, this means the action is happening all around us, in front of us at one end of the room, at the other end of the room, and then in a kind of alley runway conformation. So we actually wouldn't be in this church basement during the action of this play, but it is still so effective. It's a really theatrical approach. And I have to say, if there's a movie, it won't be like this.
Uh-huh. Now, you talk about the actor who plays the lead and the lead puppet. What about the other actors? Does everybody operate a puppet?
I don't want to give too much away, but I will say, in terms of the other puppets, there is a very graphic scene between Tyrone and the puppet that is made by the girl that Jason has the crush on. So there are other puppets, but the rest of the actors are primarily playing human beings. And the play's co-star, besides Tyrone, of course, is a Baltimorean, Susan Rome. She plays Jason's mother.
She's a terrific actor. I love Susan Rome.
Exactly. And she's a Baltimore School for the Arts grad. She's done a lot of work at Center Stage. And the play really focuses on the efforts of Jason and his mother to come to terms with life after his father's death. Susan Rome plays the mother as a woman who has a very tenuous grasp on day-to-day life. She has completely lost track of her son's needs. She barely has a grasp on her own. And as she explains to Ryan McBride, who plays the teenage bully, things are getting a little difficult for her.
I've had a hard year. I have one thing in my life that is keeping me together, and that is my dedication to my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. And because I can't sing, and I can't preach, and my brownies taste like old tires, I am trying to teach myself and you how to do puppet shows. Now, if you don't want to come here, you don't have to come here. Go smoke in the parking lot. I will tell your mother you're in here. But please, leave me alone. I beg you. Leave me alone.
So you and I go back a long way. I mean,
yes.
Way before we started doing the show together. So I've known for a while that you're a big fan of puppets. Did you study puppetry like at Brown University or some prestigious university of puppetry or something?
Yes, I did.
And you did a workshop even this summer, right?
Yes, I did some more puppetry this summer in New York.
So, you know, when folks hear the word puppet, they think maybe this is a thing for children. But I take it, we just need to emphasize this. This is not a show for children, right?
It is definitely not a show for children. It has all those things disclaimers usually warn you about besides the language and sexual situations and violence. It has thematically very heavy issues, coping with death and parent-child strife, and especially the inadequacy and the hypocrisy of organized religion. Everybody but Jason is so wrapped up in their own needs that Jason sort of falls by the wayside. He becomes this empty vessel who's ripe for takeover by Tyrone, or to put it another way, by the forces of evil. But he grows up in the play, and so does his mother. I can't say the same for Tyrone. It is a very funny play, but it's very black humor. I did make a puppet right before the show, but I have to say, Tom, after seeing Hand to God, I was a little afraid to take my puppet home. That's how strong this stuff is. It's terrific and terrifying.
Well, you've brought your puppet in this morning, and it's cute, and we'll have a picture with you and your puppet on our website at WIPR.org. All right. Thanks so much, Judy. I appreciate it, and this sounds like a good one.
Yep. Watch out for puppets, Tom.
Indeed. Hand to God continues at the Studio Theater in D.C. It's there until Sunday. As I said, we'll have information and a picture of Judy's puppet, WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. That's it for us today. Coming up on Wednesday, we'll have Voices of the Uprising with reporter Mary Wiltenberg. We'll also have an interview I did with Reverend Dr. Robert Franklin about imagining justice in Baltimore, and Todd Marcus, a fantastic bass clarinetist. Hope everybody can join us for Maryland Morning on Wednesday morning. Till then, for Nathan Sterner and the entire Maryland Morning team, I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day. I'm your puppet.